The UN gets ready to release Gaddafi's billions to rebel leaders.
Money they'll need to build a new government and economy.
From APM American Public Media, hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson in Los Angeles.
And in New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith in for Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for downloading the podcast from Marketplace.org. It's Wednesday, August 24th.
Coming up, luxury home builder Toll Brothers is making money.
And North Korean dictator Kim Jong-il visits Russia, and it's all business.
Those stories and much more coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Colonel Muammar Gaddafi appeared on television in Libya today and ordered his followers to fight, but a victory for the rebels seems imminent. In fact, today the UN says it's drafting a resolution to unfreeze Libyan assets and relax sanctions.
Billions of dollars worth of Libyan assets have been frozen for months, and when the fighting began in Libya, Marketplace's Stephen Beard accompanied a real estate expert named William Green to some London mansions owned by Gaddafi's family.
Well, this is a beautiful house. It's got an in-and-out drive. It's a double-fronted neo-Georgian residence.
And it has some pretty luxurious facilities.
You have a private cinema. I gather this one is suede-lined. I believe there's a swimming pool as well and a jacuzzi.
Well, Stephen is back on the beat today looking into if and when Gaddafi's assets will be released. He joins us now from London. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Jeremy.
Well, the fighting is still going on in Libya. Is it a bit too early to be debating this?
Well, not really. I mean, the rebels need cash. The rebel council, the NTC, has been living on handouts from sympathetic countries like Qatar and Kuwait. But it needs a lot more cash now, and not only for the obvious things like food and medical supplies. Once the fighting stops, and let's hope it stops fairly soon, it's going to need to establish its authority in Tripoli and throughout the whole country. And it's going to need money for that, to pay the police, to pay the civil servants. And the frozen assets could be the most immediate source of that cash.
OK, so let's say they decide to release the funds. First of all, who do they send the check to?
Well, that, of course, is the big problem. There's still a lot of doubt about the rebel council, the NTC. Can it be totally trusted? Will some of this cash end up lining some personal pockets, wind up in some personal bank accounts? An even bigger worry, though, says Shashak Joshi of a London think tank, the Royal United Services Institute, a bigger worry is that the council may have indirect links with Islamist groups that have very hostile to the US and Europe.
No one wants to see state funds released only to wind their way to Al-Qaeda affiliates. Not to say that's probable, but it is possible and it's a risk no one's willing to take.
And he says that means the US and Europe will be very cautious and careful in unfreezing these Libyan assets, and initially will probably only release tens of millions rather than billions of dollars.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Stephen, you'll be taking a look later today on Marketplace at what Muammar Gaddafi still owns around London. We'll tune in for that. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks very much, Jeremy.
Getting that money will be key to helping a fledgling Libyan government grow and develop a stable economy. Joe Ford joins us now. He's a senior analyst with Oxford Analytica. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning.
So, Joe, it seems as if a rebel victory is fairly close at hand. What are some of the first steps a new government would have to take?
I think the first point to remember is the limited utility of making comparisons from other places, whether they be Iraq, Afghanistan, or other countries that have been through transition. But it is possible to draw some broader lessons from these sorts of things. They generally relate to issues around security sector reform and integrating opposing forces into a national police and army, transitional justice issues and how one deals with those, the economy and providing some sort of momentum in bread and butter terms to people.
As you mentioned, we've seen a lot of countries go through the Arab Spring, obviously all very different countries. But are there any models among those that might work for Libya or parts of those situations that are parallel to Libya's situation?
Well, there's been a lot of talk comparing the Libya situation with Iraq. One of the things that's very different about the Libya and Iraq situation is that the Transitional Provisional Authority in Iraq was a U.S. administration, whereas the Transitional National Council is composed of Libyans themselves. So legitimacy and effectiveness are interlinked issues when it comes to these sorts of transitions.
Well, one of the tasks of a new government obviously would be building up a strong functioning economy. That requires things like, you know, a strong banking system, tax collection, things like that. How ready is a country like Libya to sustain those elements?
Libya's transition is taking place at a time when Europe, which is just across the Mediterranean, is not necessarily in a very good place to help out. So the level of despair that might usually accompany a sort of post-conflict transition is more really about the macro global environment than Libya's own potential, which is still relatively good.
Joe Ford is a senior analyst at Oxford Analytica. Joe, thank you.
Thank you very much, Stacey.
Aid agencies have expressed concerns about safety and living conditions in Tripoli. Foreign workers especially have been a target of violence throughout the conflict. Well, when it comes to rebuilding Libya, a lot of the focus is going to be on foreign workers. The problem is many of them left Libya when the conflict started. And as reporter Christopher Worth explains, getting them back will be the first step to rebuilding.
Libya has had to rely on immigrants to help build and run its billion-dollar oil sector. And those migrant workers from Asia, the Middle East, and other parts of Africa made headlines fleeing en masse across the Tunisian border or by boat to Europe since the conflict erupted. The International Organization for Migration says out of 2.5 million foreign workers that were in Libya, around 660,000 have left in the past 6 months. Thousands have remained in Tripoli, either to protect business interests or in the hopes of collecting unpaid wages, a big problem for migrants caught up in the fighting. Sabella Wilkes is with the UN's refugee organization. She says now that the Gaddafi regime has collapsed, they're not likely to want to evacuate.
Those that have stayed have really stayed through the bitterest, most difficult period. And of course, they probably have the most to lose by leaving, because I think they see that there's potentially a lot of opportunity when the conflict's over.
She says migrant workers will play a big part in rebuilding Libya. Another question is whether those remaining in camps in Tunisia will return to take up their old jobs once it's safe to do so. In London, I'm Christopher Worth for Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
So, Jeremy, you heard about Joe Biden's visit to Mongolia this week.
Oh, yeah. Well, he's been traveling all over Asia, right?
He has, yes. But Mongolia specifically is in the news again today. Hmm. Its Olympic athletes have a sponsor.
Huh. And who is it?
It is mining giant Rio Tinto, of all companies. It's sending the country's little team, which is only about 30 athletes, to the London Games. Although I'm not entirely sure it's not just enlightened self-interest. Mongolia is very mineral rich, and it's a huge battleground for mining companies. And Rio Tinto actually has more money than the country of Mongolia. Mongolia's GDP is around $7 billion, and Rio Tinto's worth more than $80
billion. Wow. So, maybe they should just buy them.
Mongolia brought to you by Rio Tinto. Speaking of companies, luxury home builder Toll Brothers reported its earnings jumped last quarter. But the company is paring back its sales hopes for the rest of the year because of the weak housing market. Jennifer Collins has more on that.
Analyst Jack Masenko of Susquehanna Financial says Toll Brothers has been successful selling homes that people actually want to buy.
You have older folks, baby boomers retiring, and they want to age in place. They don't want to be climbing upstairs.
So in Florida, for example, Toll's built homes with master suites on the first floor. Citigroup analyst Josh Levin says for the urbanite,
Toll has actually really started to expand in New York City and the New York environments by going to apartment buildings, building skyscrapers. That's been their hottest market in the country for the past year.
Levin says Toll Brothers has had a leg up because luxury properties don't compete with homes in the low end of the market, which has been hobbled by foreclosures. Still, the company's only selling about a quarter of the homes it sold during the bubble. Megan McGrath is an analyst with investment consultants MKM Partners.
They have to hustle to sell their homes. This is a very, very, very tough market.
She says luxury buyers tend to have more of their wealth in the stock market. So when the market is volatile, like right now, the wealthy may be more hesitant to buy. The average price of a Toll Brothers home has dropped around 20% since 2006. Morris Davis, a real estate professor at the University of Wisconsin, doesn't expect these prices to stay low forever. Historically low interest rates are bound to lure in more buyers.
The housing market will recover because it has to. There's population growth and people will need homes.
And he says the first sign of life seems to be in luxury. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Some good news this morning from the Commerce Department. Durable goods orders rose 4% in July. Those are orders for big ticket items like computers and cars. Most of that spending was on aircraft and defense orders. Businesses, on the other hand, are spending less on equipment.
And some analysts are pointing to the durable goods orders as a reason for what the markets are doing today. In early trading, they are a bit higher. Now, yesterday, the Dow jumped more than 300 points, and analysts are attributing that to anticipation about a speech on Friday from Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke. So are these analysts right, or do they just make this stuff up? For more, let's turn to Richard DeKayser. He's an economist with the Parthenon Group. He's with us from Boston, as he is every Wednesday. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning.
So, Richard, everyone is attributing this big 300-point jump yesterday in the Dow to excitement about what Fed Chair Ben Bernanke might say on Friday. What exactly are people waiting for him to do?
Well, you know, a little background first, Jeremy. It was exactly a year ago at the same conference, Jackson Hole, Wyoming, Fed Chairman Bernanke spoke about policy options or tools in the toolkit that it could use if the economy were to weaken. And included among those was buying more government securities. And lo and behold, 2 months later, they did exactly that in what we now call Quantitative easing, QE2. Right. So the speculation is that that's going to happen again. Of course, there's absolutely no evidence to suggest that he is going to do that. In fact, there's some evidence to the contrary. But nonetheless, it's that hope that really juiced the markets yesterday.
All right. Well, Richard, when we hear that the market jumps 300 points on Ben Bernanke or drops X number of points on this or that, how often is that actually the reason for the jump, and how often is it just a guess?
Short answer, usually, but not always. You know, there's two schools of thought on this. Fundamental analysis basically says the stock market is a big assimilation mechanism, and information flows in and prices respond accordingly. But that's not always the case. There's another school called technical analysis, which says that there can be factors behind the scenes which aren't well understood that often influence prices, but that just doesn't make for a good explanation.
All right. Well, Richard, I just wanted to tell you before we let you go, we got a listener email to marketplace.org yesterday from a guy named Jim Sinsky in Groveton, Texas. He says, to be more positive, instead of saying the market is down 280 points, we should just say stocks are on sale 15% off.
That would definitely be an optimistic interpretation, and there are a lot of people who agree with him.
Richard DeKayser, economist with the Parthenon Group. Thanks so much, Richard.
My pleasure. Take care.
There are reports in this morning's Wall Street Journal, Stacey, that Sprint is going to start selling the new version of the iPhone this fall.
I know. Do you know how upset I was about that? Because I did have a Sprint service, which I switched in order to get the iPhone.
No, you
like
did it
2 weeks
soon.
Ago. I'm telling you, 2 weeks ago.
They get you every time.
I know.
Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer joins us now from Washington with more on the Sprint story. Good morning, Nancy.
Hey, Jeremy.
So first off, what would a Sprint iPhone mean for Sprint and its customers?
Well, Jeremy, assuming this Wall Street Journal report is true, it means Sprint customers would get some company. Sprint is expected to pick up a lot of new accounts because of the iPhone. Sprint had been losing subscribers to AT&T and Verizon, which, of course, do sell the iPhone. Verizon started selling it early this year. I talked to Roger Kay about just how big a boost this would be for Sprint, and he's president of Endpoint Technologies, a tech consulting firm.
Apple products really draw people, so Sprint can be sure to get a boost. And I would even say that if you look at it on an annual basis, they could probably count on a double-digit boost.
And Jeremy, I reached out to Sprint this morning to get their take on this. Sprint's main spokesman emailed back that, quote, Sprint doesn't comment on rumor or speculation.
And Nancy, what would this mean for Sprint's competitors?
Well, looming in the background, there is that big $39 billion proposed merger between AT&T and T-Mobile. It still needs approval from the federal government. This could give that merger a boost. Sprint wouldn't comment on that either. But Sprint has been one of the most vocal opponents of the deal, and now AT&T can say, hey, look, Sprint is going to be a stronger competitor now. Hey, federal regulators, our merger won't hurt competition. Consumers can now choose among three companies that offer the iPhone.
Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer. Nancy, glad you were able to make it in despite the seismic terror in Washington yesterday. Thanks so much.
We're all a flutter here, Jeremy.
They're all a flutter. You hear that, Stacey? They are really, you guys must be very excited about this earthquake.
Hey, listen to me, Jeremy. I lived in Los Angeles for 7 years and I went through many earthquakes. And I will tell you, there was a big earthquake in New York. It got my attention. It lasted for a really long time and it was pretty. And all of the West Coasters are just making fun
of
New York.
Well, you know, and of course, I've lived on the East Coast for years until just a few months ago when I came to Los Angeles. And I have yet, knock on wood, to feel any major earthquake. So
I know. I feel gypped. I was supposed to be trading perfect LA weather for no earthquakes. And I feel like I want my
money. You got
the
worst of both worlds.
I did. Well, North Korea's reclusive leader Kim Jong-il is on a rare foreign trip to Russia today. South Korea says it shows the North's willingness to consider new economic cooperation. First and foremost, building a gas pipeline connecting South Korea to Russia. Peter Van Dyke reports now from Moscow.
Kim Jong-il is afraid of flying, so he rode his personal armored train across Siberia to meet with President Dmitry Medvedev. Stops to inspect a hydroelectric dam and a new pipeline pumping Russian oil to China are clues as to what the two leaders talked about. North Korea is in dire economic straits, and Moscow wants to expand its economic presence in Asia near China. At the same time, Russia and other countries want North Korea to drop its nuclear weapons program. Fyodor Lukyanov is the editor of the journal Russia in Global Affairs. He says wielding an international political stick hasn't worked, so shifting to an economic carrot may be a better solution.
Russia is trying to look at North Korea not as a crazy rock state, but as a normal partner for a regional economic project.
Lukyanov says it is impossible to predict how Kim Jong-il will react. He took 4 days to get to the meeting with Medvedev. Any movement on the Korean peninsula is likely to be just as slow. In Moscow, I'm Peter Van Dyke for Marketplace.
Stacey, do you use Hulu?
I do. I am a Hulu fan,
Hulu,
yes.
Hulu, of course, is the website where you can watch a lot of TV shows on demand. And today it goes up for sale. Now, the current owners include media giants like News Corporation and Disney. But as Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports, finding a new owner may not be so simple.
Hulu has a strong brand name, it carries a lot more TV shows than rival YouTube, and it has another thing going for it.
The new Stella Artois Charlie Scan.
You really can't fast forward through the commercials for Hulu.
Analyst Rob Enderle follows the tech industry. He says Yahoo or Microsoft could be interested buyers, but Enderle says Hulu's main problem is that it doesn't own the shows it broadcasts.
The difficulty is determining what the value is since they don't own the content or really control it that much.
News Corp and Disney figure they can cut out the middleman and show their TV shows on their own websites.
The folks that own the content seem to want to go directly to the consumer and capture all the revenue for it.
If Hulu can't find a media company to buy it, Enderle says it may need to evolve into its own network, perhaps creating programs just for the internet. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
The Environmental Protection Agency is getting tough on coal power plants. A new rule requires a drop in sulfur dioxide emissions of more than 70% by 2014. Dan Bobkoff of Midwest Reporting Project Changing Gears has that story.
Remember acid rain? We don't hear as much about it anymore because regulations force coal power plants to clean up their smokestacks. The weapon? So-called scrubbers that stop stuff like sulfur dioxide from seeping into the air. A few years ago, the industry largely switched to a new stainless steel design.
This was supposed to be the best alloy available at that point in time, the most cost-effective alloy available at that point in time.
Bill Sigmund is the senior vice president at American Electric Power. To meet EPA requirements, the Ohio company has been installing scrubbers at many of its coal plants, costing as much as $700 million each. They're supposed to last 25 years. But very quickly, Sigmund and his team started noticing some serious corrosion.
It's almost like a, a laser torch or something that's eating the metal itself.
So the industry called on its scientists at the Electric Power Research Institute to investigate. John Schingeldecker is the senior project manager.
For utilities that have built in the last 10 years, that's a very big deal. It's costing a lot more in the short term than they anticipated.
American Electric Power alone has already spent $30 million putting on protective coatings to treat the corrosion. Mehrouz Zamazadeh says the industry should have done its homework. He's general manager of Matco Services, a corrosion analysis firm.
Stainless steels are in general corrosion resistant. However, like everything else in life, they have their limits.
All this comes as those new EPA rules force utilities to make decisions, invest in coal scrubbers, shut the plants down, or replace them with something else, like natural gas. Sandy Buchanan is with the advocacy group Ohio Citizen Action.
The question of whether they're going to install the scrubbers, the question of whether they're going to fix the scrubbers, I mean, every penny of that is going to get passed along to consumers in one form or another.
Oh, and by the way, the cost of a new natural gas plant, about the same as one new scrubber. In Cleveland, I'm Dan Bobkoff for Marketplace.
And finally to the UK, Stacey, where a pet store called Creature Company has launched a new service called Speed Petting.
Speed Petting?
Speed Petting. It's like speed dating, except it's with pets. And you're not dating them. You're just trying to figure out which one is right for you. You get to cycle through up to 15 pets for 2 minutes apiece at the store. You pet them, and then
you figure out
which one is the one you should take home. And the owner of the store tells London's Metro newspaper that it's perfect for busy people who don't have time to find the right pet. And I wonder if he's going to warn them that if they don't have time to go shopping for a pet, they might not have time to walk the pet, feed the pet, take care of the pet, or do any of the other things you need to do as a pet owner.
Hey, Jeremy, as a new Yorker, I can tell you that is what nannies are for. Nobody raises their own children.
That's terrible.
And
that's
apparently
terrible.
Now nobody raises their own pets. That's so 90s.
Oh, boy. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And in New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith, in for Steve Chiatakis. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.